Hello. In this audio snippet, we would like to talk about two people in particular, two people from the Civil War and post-Civil War period in America, and to contrast their lives. Their lives are in some ways very similar, but then they ended very differently, and their lives, I guess, also speak to the situation of America in general throughout its history, and now as its history is winding down. As we've said before, we're a few weeks away from America dying. It's only a matter of weeks now, and America's calling will be dead, and this will become a third world country. And just as a side note, I have felt the darkness just and the oppression and the depression just growing and growing. It is very intense at times. And I've been hearing stories about the suicide rate in America being very high right now. And a lot of people are blaming that on cannabis use, and I think it's not a coincidence. I've constantly been cursing cannabis users, especially because I have to put up with that nonsense here in the New York area because of the worthless white fascist Democrats, liberal Democrats who have imposed this on us, that they have legalized the use of cannabis, so you can feel the stench of these worthless lives, these lives that do not matter, just stinking up the place. And I do believe there is a connection, and it will continue to grow. But in the midst of that, there is a I feel like a hole opening up in America. It's like we're being swallowed by this. It's like the earth is opening up, shall we say, and this big hole is just swallowing the whole country, as if the country was like a house and it's just being swallowed in. And as that is happening, I feel certain evil forces just becoming more intensified and try to harass and torment, and that's what I've been experiencing, the harassment and torment of people who are trying to seek the truth and who are speaking out against everything that's going on. It's as if they are doubling down and saying, we are not going down without a fight. We are going to show that we will prevail. And so there's this darkness increasing, the intensifying of the harassment, and a lot of it is coming from the Hispanic people. The third world influence is coming on America. And so these are dark times, sad times. It's a time of death. It's like, you know, there's a patient that you know in hospital, and he's close to dying, and there's nothing you can do about it, because the treatment that would have saved his life is being denied by the very patient who needs it. So that's where we are right now. Before we talk about these two lives, and I hope we can get to them, would like to talk about two separate things. One of them, I hope that you will see how it ties into what we'll say later about these two individuals. And it's a story that I saw the other day, about a week ago. That's when it was posted. The title of this article is mega donor threatens to cut off funding if DeSantis doesn't go moderate. This was originally posted on the Epoch Times and it was also like cross-posted on this website that I visited that I have mentioned before, NOQ Report, which was renamed to America First Report, a name I despise, but for reasons we've tried to share before. That's where you can find it if you want to look at it, because I think if you go to the Epoch Times, there might be a paywall or something. But the thing is that this story, I'm going to read parts of it. It says, Ron DeSantis' biggest individual donor, hotel entrepreneur Robert Bigelow, warned that he will cut off donations if the Republican 2024 candidate doesn't turn moderate. Quote, he does need to shift to get to moderates. He will lose if he doesn't. Extremism isn't going to get you elected, unquote, Mr. Bigelow said during an interview with Reuters, adding that he had communicated these concerns to Mr. DeSantis' campaign. So two things I want to say. One is like a kind of a non-related thing in a sense, but I just have to say it. I have shared with people that in my life, for some reason, the name Robert has always been like a sign of trouble. Whenever I run into someone named Robert, I go, oh my goodness, something bad's going to happen. And when I hear I'm watching the news or criminal shows or shows that document real life murders and stuff like that, I'm surprised at how often the guy doing this horrendous stuff is called Bob, you know, short for Robert. And I don't know why I don't know what it is about that name. There's something off about it. And if that's your name, I hope I'm not offending you. So if you ever meet me and you introduce yourself and your name is Robert, it might do you better if you just use your middle name instead of Robert. Because if I hear your name is Robert, I'm going to wonder, you know, what's wrong with you, or what you're about to do to me or try to do to me. And I don't know why. It seems to be more of an American thing. It's as if Roberts from other parts of the world are not as evil. And that's what I have perceived. It's something about the name Robert in the context of America. I'm not sure what it is, but there's something off with that name. So I'm not surprised that this bastard, his name is Robert Bigelow, and he is trying to force DeSantis to go moderate. So the second thing I wanted to mention here and related to this comment, and we have written something about that in the next posting that will be posted hopefully not too far from now, that will be posted on the website where these recordings are posted, written posts. I'm going to just give you a little preview of what is going to be posted in written form. I usually don't ever talk about what's about to be posted in written form, but I'll just share a little bit of it. And it relates to the comment that's being made by this Bob Bigelow when he said extremism isn't going to get you elected. I've always heard that all the time, you know, the importance of moderation. You need to, you can't go to extremes because when you're at an extreme, then you are going to, you're more than likely going to be wrong. And I've always despised that parameter, because that becomes a parameter for testing whether or not you're in the truth or not. I mean, that's what people start doing. Oh, am I near the edge? Because extreme means the edge. That's what they're talking about. You're at the edge. Like if there's a range of 0 to 100%, then an extremist, you know, based on the terminology that the people who talk about this use, extremism is when you're close to 0% or 100%, you know, either on one side of the spectrum or the opposite side. And so people go, okay, if I'm close to one of the edges of the spectrum, then I must be wrong because extremism is wrong. And that becomes a very dangerous way for judging what is right and what is wrong. And one of the examples we share on the posting that will be written, and I feel bad about kind of saying it ahead of time, but I guess I'll just go ahead and do it. If you are cooking, let's say that someone is cooking some exotic dish, and the dish is made with these wild berries that, you know, you have to go pick in the field and stuff. But it turns out that some of those berries are poisonous. And that requires a close inspection of each berry, you know, because the poisonous berries are known to have a certain characteristic. But you have to kind of look for it to detect it. Let's say that somebody's preparing a dish with those berries. And would you want the cook to be moderate and non-extremist about making sure that no poisonous berries get introduced into the dish you're about to eat? Would you like him to be moderate? Like, oh, you know, you can't be extreme. Like, oh, I can't go with 100% safe berries and 0% poisonous berries, because that is extremism. So I'm just going to go with moderation. You know, I'm just going to maybe 75% safe berries and 25% poisonous berries, because I don't want to be extremist. If someone said that to you, you'd go, you know, you're crazy. I'm not going to eat your food. Because in that case, you want the guy to be a little bit extremist. And even if it's a bit of a hassle to look through each berry to find the feature or the characteristic that makes it poisonous, you would want the guy to take the time to do that, because you don't want to get poisoned by the dish. So in that case, the person has to exercise extremism. He has to aim for 100% safe berries and 0% poisonous berries, and that's the right thing to do. You know, it's like, for example, in the U.S., we used to have some states that had slavery and some states that didn't. So I don't know the actual percentage, but let's say it was 50-50. I know it was not that, but maybe it was 60-40, but regardless, the thing is, would you want balance in that regard? Do you want, like, oh yeah, we can't be extremist about slavery? No, slavery is fine. I mean, we can't just be so radical about it. It's okay to have, you know, let's aim for this 50-50 balance, because we like to be balanced. Balance and moderation, that is the key to harmony and life, a good life. Would you be for that idea that, yeah, let's be moderate about slavery, let's not be radical and extremist about it? And obviously the answer would be no. You have to be radical about it. It's 100% no, or 0% slavery, 100% free states. That's what we want. And as we have mentioned before, the radical Republicans, that was the name, kind of almost in, set in as a way to denigrate them. The radical Republicans were the group in Congress in Washington during the Civil War years and the post-Civil War period, who were literally radical about ending slavery, and not only ending slavery but giving freedom, true freedom, to Black people, especially after they were set free from slavery. And they fought against all the Southern efforts to reinstate a subtle slavery over Black people again after the Civil War. And they were called radical Republicans. Lincoln hated them. Lincoln hated them. And a lot of Republicans just were kind of a little bit iffy or cautious about this extremism thing, you know, because they thought these radicals were going too far. But you look back and you go, yeah, that they were doing the right thing. It's just that we as a country chose not to be extremists, quote unquote, about giving true freedom to Black people. And that's what led to a lot of the problems. So whenever you hear somebody say, oh, extremism is wrong, you're talking to an idiot, talking to a person who just doesn't know what he's talking about. Because it is never, the question is never, are you on the edges of the spectrum? The question is, are you on the right position, the right place in that spectrum? You have to hit the right note. If you sing a song, if you're a singer by profession, you don't want to be off key 50% of the time whilst you're singing the song. You want to be 100% on key throughout the entire song. That's what you aim for. You aim for perfection. Now, obviously, sometimes when you aim for perfection, you can go over the top, and there's sometimes you can get to 95, 98, 99% perfection, but that 1% has such a high cost in terms of your effort to achieve it, that pursuing that extra 1% just to get to 100% becomes counterproductive. But one thing that I do believe is when it comes to seeking the truth and trying to live by the truth, the effort should be 100%. There is no evaluation of price to pay. It's either you go for 100% or you don't. That is the goal. But I'm talking about practical situations. For example, if you are, let's say, a software developer and you're writing the system, and you know that it's like 95, 97% perfect of what you would want to achieve, you know, like a solid, robust system that will never fail. But if the effort to get that software to go from 97% robust to 100%, sometimes that effort, that little extra, is so overwhelmingly complex or effort filled that it's not worth pursuing. So at that point, you have to kind of go a little practical and go, okay, this is not perfect, but achieving perfection here, in this case, it becomes actually a sign of a deeper imperfection in the person. It's like when you become obsessed about something that is not worth obsessing about, then at that point, the perfection you're seeking is actually a manifestation of a deep imperfection in your inner being, if I'm making sense. So somebody who's a neat freak, you know, everything has to be perfectly, organized. Everything has to be perfectly clean, not one speck of dust. That's when you get to a level of obsession. So you could say that in those situations, the right value to aim for is 97, 98. I'm just giving some symbolic number, 97, 98%, and not 100. So, you can't have a perfectly clean house with it where everything is completely spotless and there's not one speck of dust, but you don't want to be to have a sloppy house, and live in a sloppy environment. At least you shouldn't. I'm a little bit sloppy personally, and I'm kind of ashamed of that sometimes. But the thing is that you have to aim for a high level of neatness or order, but sometimes you can't aim for 100% because there are more important things to worry about, and it becomes a question of priorities. Where sometimes you if you obsess over something that's minor, then you lose touch with more important things to deal with. So sometimes priorities come in and they lower the percentage from 100% to something else, because there are more important things to worry about. When you are seeking perfection, the perfection as a human being, then sometimes you have to forego technical perfection in some things, because you're investing your time in other things of higher value. I hope I'm making sense, but the point is that if anyone comes and tries to tell you to judge something by whether it's true or false by the concept of extremism, then just turn around and walk away. Don't listen to that person. That person does not understand reality. Because then I can go, you can turn it around on a person who starts talking like that. Then you can start asking him or her, are you 100% convinced that we should never be extreme about everything, that we should seek moderation all the time? And they'll go, yes, I would believe in the importance of moderation. So you're saying that you are seeking moderation 100% of the time. So you're not moderate about your moderation. In other words, you are not willing to be non-moderate in some things. Are you extremist? And see what I'm trying to get at. People who talk like that automatically contradict themselves, because they are then imposing on people an extreme view of moderation. They're saying you have to be moderate. You have to aim for the 50% mark on all things all the time. And if you don't, then you're not right. Then they're being extreme about their moderation. And then they are contradicting their own philosophy. And any philosophy that is self-contradictory is not worth its salt. So you can see very clearly this Bob Bigelow, worthless idiot. And the thing is, these people who talk like that, the importance of balance and moderation and not being extreme, they always sound so wise. You know, they feel like you're talking, listening to Yoda, or some sort of Indian sage who comes and says, please, my brother, you must seek a moderation and love and peace and harmony. And so they sound so wise and thoughtful and insightful, but it's actually total stupidity. It's a moron. You're listening to a moron impersonating a wise person. So it's never a question of whether you're on an extreme or not. The question is, are you on the right amount? You know, how much slavery do we want? Do we want 100% slavery or 0% slavery? Do we want 50% slavery? Obviously, we want 0% slavery. That's an extreme view. But it doesn't make it wrong. You just have zero, because in this particular case, 0% just happens to be the right amount. So that's kind of what we have to be aware of whenever anyone talks about extremism. And the radical Republicans, we were saying, they were extremists, but they were doing the right thing, and unfortunately they did not prevail because America did not allow them to prevail. But I'm going to continue reading here in this article. It says, Mr. Bigelow, founder of Las Vegas-based Bigelow Aerospace, donated $20 million to the pro DeSantis Never Back Down Super PAC in March, which makes him the biggest donor to the group. The second biggest individual donor to Never Back Down is venture capitalist Douglas Leone, who gave $2 million, according to campaign filings, a tenth of what Mr. Bigelow contributed. When I read that paragraph, it just shocked me, like, my goodness. So this one man has the ability to give $20 million to DeSantis, and he can give it to him through this super PAC, PAC, Political Action Committee, I think is the acronym that stands for, what that acronym stands for. So he can influence DeSantis and say, okay, you do my bidding, because if you don't, then the next 20 million that I will want to give to you are not going to be there. And that's a very dangerous thing. So The people, you know, writing this article, and most of the people, the conservatives who read it, don't quite, they get caught up in, oh, DeSantis is, you know, being manipulated by the swamp, and they start thinking about all this stuff. But they don't look at this little detail. How in the hell do we have a political system where one person can give $20 million indirectly through a political action committee to a candidate and then have the power to sway that candidate in different directions based on the money? Because now, you know, that's why this article was written. You know, if this guy had given $25 and then said this, the exact same thing, there'd be no article about him that I'd be talking about. The reason why, you know, he has this article written about him is because he clearly, because of all the money he's given, he has an influence on DeSantis. Whether DeSantis will listen to him or not is a separate thing, but the thing is the influence, the potential influence is there. And as we've said before, the problem is, and it's something that we haven't addressed in the American system, and it goes to some of the things that we have talked about regarding the Civil War in recent audio, the post-Civil War period in recent audio snippets. And it's the fact that we need a system where every individual can only donate up to a certain amount to a candidate. It can, and no group should ever be allowed to donate to a political campaign or a candidate. Never. No company, no union, no political action committee, nothing. As we've said before, it is evil when unions donate to the Democrat Party, because sometimes in some companies, if you're not union, then you can't work there. So you're forced to give these union dues. You're paying into the union, and whether you like it or not, and then that union turns around and gives money to the Democrats. So even if you're anti-Democrat party, there's nothing you can say about it, because it's the big kahunas, the big leeches at the top of the union who decide how to, you know, use that money, and they turn it into kickbacks and all that stuff and so forth. It's unfair when a group gives, when a company gives to a party, it's the same thing, because people working in that company are almost being forced to donate to something that they have no loyalty to, because that money, instead of being paid to the employees, is being paid by the company. So groups should never, and the only situation where it would be morally justifiable would be where every individual member of the group consents to that donation. But let's not even go there. Let's just say no group donation, full stop, end of story. Only individuals can donate to a party. It should be a constitutional clause. And it would have been there in the new American Constitution had this country survived and been able to implement it. Maybe it will be implemented somewhere else, because the concept of the new American Constitution that we have been talking about in these audio recordings is not going to die with America. It will just be wrapped up and taken somewhere else. And in some way, somehow, eventually, it will be implemented somewhere. So that would be a core principle. But no one seems to go there, because it's as if not even the conservatives who complain about the corruption and the, quote, swamp and all that, and they don't want to go there because it implies making fundamental changes and recognizing that we have been fundamentally flawed from the start, and they never want to go there. So their mind never goes, okay, then let's go to the deeper problem. And this has to do with the post-Civil War period, because of the spoil system and the half-breeds and the stalwarts that we talked about earlier. And that became a big distraction to helping black people truly be free. So this is all related, whether sometimes it looks like we're talking about all these disparate or unrelated topics, but they're all very strongly intertwined. So it's not a coincidence sometimes when I feel out of nowhere, I feel prompted by the truth to talk about certain things, and as I start talking about them, I realize, oh, it's all connected, and that's why I was being compelled to talk about these things. So the thing is that, and by the way, aside from putting a limit, and the limit should be, the individual limit should be very low, like something like $300 or $400, and it would be maybe, if it was added in the Constitution, I don't think it would be a good idea to hard code the number. It would be more fitting to kind of put it in proportion to the average household income. So in the current economic situation we're in at the time of this recording, I would say a $400 limit would be a valid limit. No individual can ever donate more than $400 during the whole year to a candidate. And so if the candidate wants to get financed, he just has to make sure that he reaches a lot of individuals. And anyone who violates this would suffer severe punishment. It wouldn't just be a slap on the wrist or, oh, you shouldn't have done that. No, jail time. And candidates who will or who knowingly accept more than the limit from an individual should also face criminal charges, and possible disqualification from you know the office they are running for. And aside from that, there should also be, I believe, a total limit for all the contributions you can make to all candidates. I really don't know what that amount would be, but I would kind of put it maybe at 10% or 15% of your annual of an average American household's annual income. So let's say if the average household income is $60,000 per year, and let's say 15% of that would be, I think, $9,000, if I'm not mistaken, then that would be the most you can donate to all candidates of any type for the whole year. That would prevent like a millionaire just giving like $400 here, $400 there, and then just giving millions and millions of dollars to a party, let's say the Democrat Party, by giving money to all these candidates in all these states and all these races. So, because that would be like a way of getting around the limitation in some sense. So no individual can influence a political party or the entire political system by more than $9,000 a year. And because 15% of your income, I mean, if you're, that means a deep level of commitment to political causes. And 15% of the average household income, even if you're a multimillionaire, it's not 15% of your multimillions, it's 50% of the average household income. Because even though you're a millionaire, in the eyes of, within the political system, you should be equal. There should be no power clots. Even if you have money, you cannot be more influential than a person with no money. You should be your level of influence should be more determined by the quality of your ideas, of your voice. So even like if you're a person who is like, you know, an influencer, I forget the term they use nowadays. But if you're an influencer or somebody who has a large audience, you can influence a lot of people into voting for a candidate. But it's not going to be through money, but more through you speaking to people and exposing ideas and convincing them through ideas that, yeah, this candidate is right. Or influencing the thinking of candidates by promoting ideas and kind of making them think and go, okay, yeah, that idea sounds good. So I'm going to listen to this guy because his ideas or her ideas are interesting. That's how you should be influencing, not just through money. And that scenario, that non-money influence can be as large and wide as, there'd be no constitutional limit on that. Because if your idea is awesome and it impacts millions of people and it gets millions of people to vote for someone or against someone, then more power to you. But it won't be because you just have a whole lot more money than another person. So let me just mention, continue reading this article, and I'm taking too long here, but it says, when asked about which policies he doesn't agree with, Mr. Bigelow specifically mentioned the 6-week abortion ban Mr. DeSantis signed in April after the Florida legislature passed the bill. The bill was signed after Mr. Bigelow made the massive donation. So it's always the same thing. Okay, either you're for abortion or you're not. I mean, you can't be like, let's just have 50. And that's what conservatives go for at the end, even though they're hypocritically saying, oh, yeah, we are against abortion. But when you press them on the issue, they go, abortion should be up to the states. Okay. So you're saying that you're okay with babies being butchered, or fetuses, whatever you want to call them, being butchered in New York State, but not in Texas. So if you have like half of the states allowing abortion and half of the states not allowing abortion, you'd be fine with that, right, conservative? Yes, because abortion should be up to the states. Then don't give me the crap that you are pro-life. Either abortion should be allowed or it should be banned completely. You can't have a middle ground there. You have to be a radical. You have to be, quote, an extremist about it. Now, this Mr. Bigelow, what is he implying with this? Is he implying that it's okay to abort after a certain period, or before a certain period? What does he say? I mean, either you think that that thing inside the woman's belly is worth protecting, or you don't. Full stop. End of story. But obviously this guy is anti-extremism, so who knows where he stands on that. It says here, he said he would not donate more money for now. Quote, not until I see that he's able to generate more on his own. I'm already too big a percentage, he said. Quote, a lot of his donors are still on the fence. So this is kind of like just pointing out some of the fundamental flaws in the system that we need to change. We should never have any power class, nobody being allowed to be more influential than others except for the power of their ideas. And that goes to what we've said so many times about changing the way Congress works. There should be no Speaker of the House, there should be no Senate Majority Leader, no Senate Minority Leader, there should be no parties. Everyone goes in as an individual and has equal power to influence and put bills on the floor based on a very democratic system of up and down votes by their colleagues, instead of just being given the scepter and saying, you are the Speaker of the House and you decide what bill gets to the floor. You decide who gets to sit in what committee. And the guy in the committee gets a mini scepter and he says, you decide if a bill survives your committee and gets to the floor. They have to pass through your little committee, your little fiefdom, your little kingdom. And you give the thumbs up or thumbs down. No, it should be a democratic system. And the sad thing is, even as all of this is happening in front of our face, we don't seem to go, okay, let's go to the fundamental root of the problem. Let's solve it at the root. But because the root says founding fathers, double F, F squared, they go, oh, no, you can't touch this. Whatever the founding fathers left, we don't mess with it. Whether they left it directly or indirectly, if it's kind of at the root of our... Because the problem is the players. And I'm going to go off topic a little bit very quickly. I've shared before, you know, how interesting it is when you contrast the American culture. There's there has been up to until now like a level of trust that you don't see in like third world countries. For example, when I go to buy groceries and I have to walk past certain stores here in Hoboken, sometimes they have I go past stores that have the clothes kind of outside. So they're unattended. They're on these, you know, they have these hangers and the clothes are hanging out there. And the idea is to kind of entice people who are walking by to stop and look at the clothes and inspect them. And if they like something, then they would go in and ask for the price or whatever and buy it. But I go, you know, I'm walking by and I go, my goodness, they're all very busy inside the store. You know, they're not minding the clothes that are outside. I could just grab one of those, pieces of clothing, and make it, and maybe even do it kind of in a very simulated kind of non-obvious way, and just keep going. And who would know? Who would catch me doing it? And I go, interesting. But you would never see that in a third world country, because in a third world country they know that if they leave those clothes out there like that, those clothes are going to be gone. But that has been changing in this country. But just look at San Francisco and some places where people just go in, shoplift, and no one does anything about it. And if the employees try to do something about it, they get fired. That's how radical we've gotten, extremist, but in the wrong direction. But what I'm trying to say is that we have had, but why have we had this culture of trust? That's why we have so much identity fraud, theft in America, because we were built on a system of very, very loose trust. And why were we able to do that? And that, in fact, that was also very helpful to our economic development, because in a country where you're constantly having to worry about somebody ripping you off, you, first of all, you don't venture into risky things as easily. And number two, you have to spend a lot of money to protect yourself. You know, it's like if you're living in a tough neighborhood and you know that there's a lot of chances of your house being, broken into, you're going to have to spend a lot of money in a good alarm system. So an economy that has to worry about its own people ripping each other off has to spend a lot of resources against that. So money that could have been used to generate a new business or whatever, or generate a new venture or increase the productivity of a company, all of that has to go into all of this protection stuff. So we have been able to prosper in part because we've had a society of people with moral values, with certain character. And as that character has been eroded, then, you know, that is having consequences in our whole system from an economic and a moral standpoint. But what I'm trying to say is that we have had a system that has thrived because we've had people with moral character. And what conservatives stupidly don't understand is that they think that we have succeeded because of our moral character. Hence, that proves the moral consistency and the moral strength and quality of the system. And it's not the system, it's the people. The people working within a very ambiguous and badly defined system. But because the people were moral and ethical, for the most part, the system thrived. But it didn't thrive because of itself, it thrived because of the people. And the analogy is, like, as we've said before, with like a football team. You can have a football team that plays with a lousy system. Of play, lousy strategy system, but let's say that a lot of the players are very talented, so their talent makes up for the crappy system, and people go, they're winning. That proves the system is good. No, it just proves they are good players. It's not the system; it's them. But the problem is that if the system is bad, eventually you cannot sustain, you know, eventually your success is going to end. Because it's going to degrade, and you won't be able to get good players all the time, and eventually the system will evidence its lack, and then it will expose itself, and that's what's happening in America right now, that we have we keep thinking we have survived all this time, so we just have to continue the way things are. We just have to change the people. We just have to kick those Democrats out of the White White House and Congress, and we'll be back on track. And that's what DeSantis and Trump are thinking. We just have to change the people and everything will be okay because the system was great. No, the system was a piece of crap. The system is what enabled all of this disaster to happen. But we never go there. So a fundamental little thing here that people could pick up from reading the story, oh, we need to change the way political campaigns are funded. We can't have groups fund a candidate, and an individual can only provide up to a certain small amount to a single candidate, and a certain amount, total amount for any candidate. You know, ideas like that would revolutionize the system are never born because people say, I trust the system. The system has worked in the past. Look at how great America has been, the most powerful economy in the history of mankind, blah, 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 blah. So obviously the system worked. No, the system worked despite itself. It worked because of the people in it. But now that we don't even have the people anymore, then the system is just slowly deteriorated. And now we're in the mess we're in. So, I have spent a great deal of time on this. I wanted to make it like a 15-minute thing, but we've gone past that. But that's what we wanted to share about this this story. It just exposes, some of the things that are wrong with the country and why it's dying. It's unwilling to change. The other thing I wanted to talk about before we finally get to the two people is what's been happening with Hawaii and some problems they've had. And to be frank, I every time I hear something about Hawaii in the news, I just skip it. And the reason why is I have a great hatred or spite, or I don't know what the word is, the hate, resentment, bitterness, anger against Hawaii. I could not care less for that island. To me, it's even a shame that it's a state, an American state. And the reason why is because that's the place that opened the door for Obastrid to do what he did. He, you know, his mother was in Hawaii, and the son of a bitch who begat this turd, Obastrid Sr., you know, went to Hawaii. I think he was on some sort of scholarship or whatever. I don't remember the details, from Kenya, and he found this whore in Hawaii, and that's how Obastrid was born. And I don't care if you think that Obastrid was born in Hawaii or not. I believe he was not. But that doesn't matter. The point is Hawaii opened the door, and that's where he that's the door in America through which this evil entered. And Hawaii is very let's not judge people. Let's just love each other. You know, aloha and I forget what other terms they use, but kawabunga. I don't know what they say, but over there, but. It's just a peace and love and understanding. You know, it's like they stayed in the hippie era, and societies like that are always prone to just decay. So every time I hear something about Hawaii, it's like, I don't care. I don't care about them. I despise them. I don't care about them. But, in the news recently, that they've been mentioning it over and over again. And apparently there's been some wildfires that have been going on, and they've killed people. And I'll be very frank, I actually, instead of feeling sad about the people dying, I'm actually happy. And I know this is going to sound very evil, but to me, it's like the higher the count, the death count, the better. I did hear that the storm was going to hit Hawaii, and it looked like it was going to hit it head on, and I was hoping it would hit it head on. I never found out what happened because, as I said, I don't follow Hawaii. I couldn't care less. But apparently, it missed the island, but it still went close enough to start all this. It hit the islands with very strong, powerful winds. I think I heard like 80 to 90 mile per hour winds, or I'm not sure. But it was very strong winds, and a lot of people believe the fires that are going on there are the result of down power lines because of all that strong wind, because the fires are happening in two islands, two separate islands. So it couldn't have been like an arsonist or something like that. So a lot of people believe that it was the strong winds that hit the islands that down power lines and led to these fires. And I think one of the places most impacted is a place called Lahaina. But the weird thing is, when I saw that name for the first time, which was a few hours ago on television, when I read it, because I had the volume off, what I read was Lahaina. I don't know why I felt like pronouncing it like that, Lahaina, but apparently the pronunciation is Lahaina. But Lahaina seems fitting because hyena, that mocking animal, and La, that's the Spanish definite article, feminine definite article. It's like saying the hyena in with a feminine the. So it's and it's a fitting, the hyena, the evil mocking animal, and that's what Obaster was to me. A lot of times, he had this mocking attitude about him. So he was like a hyena in many ways, more of a mandrill in his inner personality, but he evidenced a lot of hyena quality to him. He liked to mock people. He had this mocking thing, very very nasty. So it's fitting that Lahaina is the place where a lot of people are suffering, having their houses destroyed and all that in Hawaii. And it's fitting that this is happening to the 50th state, the last state that entered the American Union, just as we are winding down and America is dying. And this storm that went through near Hawaii, I think it's called Dora. And I found out a few hours ago on this Fox Weather Channel, this lady that explains a lot of things. She was saying that Dora went 5 straight days as a Category 4 storm, which was had not happened in a long, long time. And that's kind of almost unheard of. 5 straight days as a Category 4 storm as it went, from east to west across the Pacific, and it crossed all three Pacific basins as a Category 4 storm, because there's like an Eastern Pacific basin, a Central Pacific basin, and a Western Pacific basin. And the last time a Pacific storm had stayed as a Category 4 across all three basins was in 1994, and I forget, she mentioned the name of the storm. So it's been what, 94? That'd be 29 years ago, more or less. So it's a very unusual storm. It just stayed consistent on a straight line, just stayed intense throughout. It just wouldn't stop. And that's extremist. That is intense. That's what a person who is searching for the truth is like an extremist. He's like a Category 4 storm that stays like that constantly, searching and fighting for the truth. And that's what Hawaii experienced. And apparently it's going to be crossing the international line soon. And it's kind of weird, but the moment it crosses the line, it stops being a hurricane or a storm. It turns into a typhoon, because that's the terminology that's used for storms on the other side of the international dateline. So it's about to become a typhoon pretty soon, and no one knows if it's going to stay as strong once it crosses the international line and gets renamed to a typhoon. So, I saw this headline also that said Hawaii governor was declaring this the worst disaster in state history. And it's fitting, you know, the state that allowed the entrance of the man who who was the figurehead of this, of the death of the American Republic. As we've said before, the American Republic died on the 5th of November, 2008, the morning after the election of that year, when it became official that Barack Hussein Obastard had won the election. That was the moment, the day that the American Republic that the Founding Fathers had started officially died. The country and its calling had not died, but that American Republic is that there. Since then, there are no more presidents. The whole system has collapsed. That's why no one knows who can do what. And so presidents, he started doing these executive orders willy-nilly. And then Trump afterwards continued with the thing of the executive orders because the system was over. There was no this balance of powers and you know, this pathetic balance of powers that the Founding Fathers had set up. All that was just dismantled. And then we were being, quote, led by a man who was a foreigner at heart, a foreigner in a bad sense, bringing ideas of evil from the outside. And that's kind of ironic because America was being offered good ideas from the outside and for a fundamental transformation, and it kept rejecting it. So it's as if the truth said, well, okay, you don't want the fundamental transformation based on the truth because you reject foreign ideas. I'm going to let a foreign idea foreign ideas come in anyway, because the door was open. It's like the porthole was opened and we had to step through it, but because we didn't, then the porthole was used by other people to try to bring a fundamental transformation of America, but for evil, you know, bringing in all these evil ideas of communistic and very nasty, filthy ideas from the outside. And the headline I kept seeing on Fox News, it kept saying at the bottom, tragedy strikes paradise in Hawaii. And that's kind of almost like the headline of the country. You know, the country's about to die. And in many ways, it's been like a paradise, the greatest economy on earth, one of the greatest cultures, or you could say, in human history. Despite its many flaws, it's the place that people have longed to live in. That's why people come in here illegally. That's why the Cubans are willing to go through shark-infested waters and risk their lives on these little rafts to get to Florida and live the American dream. This has been the paradise that everybody has sought for and looked for. But tragedy strikes the paradise. And in a few weeks, America will be dead as a first world country. It will become just a third world piece of trash like the rest of Latin America. It will just be and that's why it's not a coincidence that in 2026, FIFA, as we said before, there are no more World Cups. The last World Cup ended at the end of extra time in 2022 in Qatar. That was the end of it. The penalties don't count, nothing. It's all over. The whole tournament is a piece of trash. But it's interesting that they have officially chosen the U.S. as the host of the 2020, the next World Cup, but it will be the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. So interesting, it will be with Mexico and the U.S. is like, so that is sort of like a symbolic sign that the U.S. is no longer its own country or separate, you know, bubble of life and prosperity in the Americas. Now it's just part of the big piece of trash that, you know, that goes from, and Canada is gone too. You know, Canada has always been like, you know, we'll do whatever everybody else does. So the U.S. dies, Canada is automatically dead with the U.S. So the U.S. and Canada used to be like this little haven of prosperity in the Americas that remained. And then to the south, all this poverty and corruption. Well, no more. Now it's going to be just one big pile of one big turd from Alaska all the way down to Tierra del Fuego. Just one giant turd, the entire Americas. And the only exception that remains is Brazil. I don't know what will be of Brazil, if Brazil will also join the turd and complete it, or if it will remain like the only, the last place of relevance, of any kind of relevance in the Americas. So, okay, so now that we've talked about those things, let's try to quickly talk about the two people who are supposed to talk about. And that would be, first let me talk about a guy that I'm pretty sure you had never heard of. I had never heard of him until recently. And I, for some reason, it's as if a voice inside was saying, you have to talk about him. And I wasn't quite sure why. And I started reading about him and I realized, oh my goodness, this guy is one of the 20 greatest Americans of all time. And it's a shame that most of us in America don't know about him. His name is, I've always had a problem with this name, so I'm sorry if I'm not pronouncing it right. Thaddeus Stevens. I don't know if it's Thaddeus or Thaddeus, but I think most people say Thaddeus. The name is so uncommon nowadays that I don't get a chance to hear it, so I don't know how to pronounce it. I think it's the name of one of the apostles in the Bible, I think. So the thing is that Thaddeus, let's call him Thaddeus Stevens. I'm going to start reading from the Wikipedia article, and I'm sorry and I apologize for just reading from the article. All I have in my heart is an impression, and the details kind of get lost, and I'm not sure how to express them, so I might as well just read them from the article. And I know that feels a little lazy on my part, but I just want to convey what I feel, but I have to go convey it through the details, because all I have in my heart is the impression, the general impression, and I don't have it like organized in my heart. I just know this man was a remarkable man. And so let me just share the details by reading through the article. So it says he was born on April 4th, 1792. And when I saw that date, I said, interesting. Because that was the day Martin Luther King died. April 4th, 1968. That's when he was murdered in Memphis. And interestingly, he died on August 11th, which is one day before the date of this recording, obviously a different year, but August 11th, 1868. So he died in 1868, 100 years before 1968, but he was born on the same day of the calendar day that Martin Luther King died. So I don't know if I'm making sense. If you look at his time of birth and time of death together, April 4th, 1792, all the way through August 11th, 1868. If you just look at the first part and the last part, you see April 4th, 1868. And that's almost April 4th, 1968, which is the date when Martin Luther King died. I know this is not a coincidence. And I hope you'll see why when I share more about him. It says here, he was a member of the House of Representatives from Pennsylvania, one of the leaders of the, quote, radical Republican faction of the Republican Party during the 1860s, the extremists. He was one of those extremists who wanted black people to be free. You know, what a radical extremist concept, right? And extremism is wrong, according to the son of a bitch, Bob Bigelow, a little moderate bastard boy. So he must be very evil because he was an extremist. He wanted freedom for black people. It says here, a fierce opponent of slavery and discrimination against black Americans, Stevens sought to secure their rights to Reconstruction, leading the opposition to U.S. President Andrew Johnson. As chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee during the American Civil War, he played a leading role, focusing his attention on defeating the Confederacy, financing the war with new taxes and borrowing, crushing the power of slave owners, ending slavery, and securing equal rights for the freedman. Stevens was born in rural Vermont in poverty and with a club foot, which left him with a permanent limp. So you can see this man was born in poverty and crippled. That was his beginning. He moved to Pennsylvania as a young man and quickly became a successful lawyer in Gettysburg. Interesting, Gettysburg, you know, the place, the Battle of Gettysburg, the decisive battle that turned the Civil War around. Many people say that the Battle of Gettysburg had been won by Robert E. Lee. Speaking of, all of this is related. I don't know why, everything is just tied together. But Robert E. Lee, son of a bitch, a leader of the Confederate Army in the South, had he won that Battle of Gettysburg, most historians believe the South would have won the war, and that would have been the end of that. So he became a successful lawyer in Gettysburg. Coincidence? I don't think so. He interested himself in municipal affairs and then in politics. He was an active leader of the Anti-Masonic Party as a fervent believer that Freemasonry in the United States was an evil conspiracy to secretly control the Republican system of government. He was elected to the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, where he became a strong advocate of free public education. Financial setbacks in 1842 caused him to move to his home and practice to the larger city of Lancaster. There, he joined the Whig Party and was elected to Congress in 1848. His activities as a lawyer and politician in opposition to slavery cost him votes, and he did not seek re-election in 1852. After a brief flirtation with the Know Nothing Party, Stevens joined the newly formed Republican Party and was elected to Congress again in 1858. And we can talk about the Know Nothing Party, but maybe not at this point. It was a relevant party in the 1850s in America. But the thing is, he flirted with that party, but eventually joined the Republican Party and won a seat in Congress as a Republican in 1858. So it says here, there with fellow radicals such as Massachusetts, fellow radicals. Doesn't that sound like, ooh, fellow nut jobs? That's what it sounds like when you read fellow radicals, fellow nut jobs, crazy radical extremists. With fellow radicals such as Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner, he opposed the expansion of slavery and concessions to the South as the war came. And I believe Charles Sumner is also in the top 20 of greatest Americans of all time, sadly unknown by most of us in America. He would have made it into the top 10, I think, if he had just, he kind of faltered at the end to a certain extent. But he would have made it into the top 10, I think, if he had stayed on course the whole time. And I think you've heard us talking about him in previous recordings. Charles Sumner was the guy who got almost beaten to death by this son of a bitch, Preston Brooks, I think his name was, representative from South Carolina who got really angry at some comments Sumner made about South Carolina and slavery. And he took a walking cane, I think it was, and just beat him up in the Senate floor. in the Senate floor in front of other senators and almost killed him. He was incapacitated for like almost 2 years, I think. I forget how long it was. It was a brutal beating, and the guy just got like a $90 fine or something when there were all these witnesses who saw him brutally attack him. He should have been, son of a bitch, should have been put in jail and maybe even sentenced to death for attacking a senator of the United States, an elected official. But the thing is that, so he and Sumner and this man that we're talking about, Thaddeus Stevens, were a powerful like tag team in a sense, fighting against slavery as part of the quote radical Republicans. So I'm going to continue reading here. Stevens argued that slavery should not survive the war. He was frustrated by the slowness of U.S. President Abraham Lincoln to support his position. He guided the government's financial legislation through the House as Ways and Means Committee. Ways and Means Committee Chairman. As the war progressed towards a northern victory, Stevens came to believe that not only should slavery be abolished, but that black Americans should be given a stake in the South's future through the confiscation of land from planters to be distributed to the freedmen. His plans went too far for the moderate Republicans and were not enacted. But the guy was saying, okay, this is not just about preserving the Union, because that was Lincoln's attitude. The son of a bitch Lincoln just kept, you know, he was to the compromiser in chief. He just wanted to get the Union back together because he didn't want to be the president who broke up the Union. He didn't want to be the president under whose watch the country split in two. He was just thinking about his historical legacy. That's all the son of a bitch cared about. And we've talked about this in the past before. Abraham Lincoln doesn't deserve to be in the top 100, top 200, top, like, even, I don't know, I wouldn't even put him in the top 1 million, but maybe that's going a little too far, who knows, of greatest Americans of all time. Stupid man, because he had such a great opportunity to transform this country, to put it on the right path, and he chose not to. He was too much of a coward to do it. Shame on him. Eternal shame on him. So the thing is that this Thaddeus Stevens didn't have the attitude of Lincoln of just saying, oh, okay, now that we're winning and we're going to reunite the country, that's it. No, he said, no, we officially ended slavery. Let's leave it at that. We not only abolish slavery, we want to give to empower black people. All the way through. So it says, after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln in April 1865, Stevens came into conflict with the new president, Johnson. And Johnson was a Democrat that Lincoln chose as his vice presidential candidate because a Democrat from the South. I mean, he was, I think, born in the North, but he became like a Southerner. He was in Tennessee, and he, for all intents and purposes, he was a Tennessean. Why the hell was this man the vice presidential candidate? Because Lincoln wanted to compromise. He wanted to show the South, I'm not against you. I'm not an extremist. I want to reconciliate. Let's kiss and make up. So just to show, you know, how much I love you all, I'm going to put this Andrew Johnson as my vice president. So when he got shot in the head, as I always add, deservedly so, then son of a bitch Andrew Johnson took over for him. And he became this big stone wall, blocking everything, preventing every effort to free black people in the South. He kept stonewalling Reconstruction. So that's why Thaddeus Stevens became very opposed to him. So it says, Stevens came into conflict with Johnson, who sought rapid restoration of the seceded states without guarantees for freedmen. The difference in views caused an ongoing battle between Johnson and Congress, with Stevens leading the radical Republicans. After gains in the 1866 election, the radicals took control of the Reconstruction away from Johnson. Johnson's term was from 1865 through 1868. those were the 4 years that Johnson was the president. So in the midterm elections of 1866, the Republicans took control, and they took Reconstruction away from Johnson. Stephens' last great battle was to secure the House articles of impeachment against Johnson, acting as a House manager in the impeachment trial, though the Senate did not convict the president. So he was the leading force, shall we say, behind the impeachment of Johnson. Johnson was, I think, the first president, American president, impeached. Clinton came a long time afterwards. But Thaddeus Stevens was the one who led the charge there. It says here then historiographical views of Stevens have dramatically shifted over the years. From the early 20th century views of Stevens as reckless and motivated by hatred of the white South to the perspective of the neo-abolitionists of the 1950s and afterwards who lauded him for his commitment to equality. So what I'm trying to the reason why I read that paragraph is to show that up until the 1950s, Americans had, in general, apparently, a negative view of Thaddeus Stevens. Like, he was a crazy man, like, radical. He just hatred for the South, and that's all he was. But in fact, this man was as full of love as you can think, because he loved his love for the his fellow black American brother and sister. That's what he had. That's the love that drove him. Instead of being a man full of hatred, this was a man full of love. And that's it's ironic that people who are full of love can sometimes exhibit the greatest levels of hatred. Because if you love something dearly, you will hate everything that is trying to destroy what you love so dearly. And that's basically the people who are transformative, who change the world, are usually viewed as the crazy, hateful ones, the ones who don't have love and understanding, who are extremists, who show no moderation, and sometimes some people are nut jobs. I mean, it doesn't mean that anyone who is radical is automatically right, because that would be stupid too. Just like people who say if you're radical then you're wrong, then the extreme opposite of if you're radical then you must be right, that is also not true. There's some radical people who are radically wrong, but the people who are transformative tend to be radical, and they tend to be labeled as hateful, or full of hatred, when in fact most of the time these are the people who exhibit the highest levels of love for truth and humanity. Let me just read parts of this. It says here that he was the second of four children, all boys, and was named to honor the Polish general who served in the American Revolution. I didn't know this. There was a Polish general called Tadeusz Kosciuszko. You'll have to look it up. Or read the Thaddeus Stevens article on Wikipedia. That's where I'm reading from. But Tadeusz, it's spelled T-A-D-E-U-S-Z, is, the Polish form of Thaddeus. So they named him after a foreign guy who came to fight for the birth of this nation. And I know that's not a coincidence. We've been talking about this infusion of foreign ideas. Things that don't sound normal or American to the average American, but which come to complete what's missing in America, and the good things that we had in America, in order to push us over the edge to cross the Jordan and enter the Promised Land. But America chose not to embrace those foreign ideas. So then they got force-fed foreign ideas from the other side, the evil side. So it says his parents were Baptists who had emigrated from Massachusetts around 1786. Thaddeus was born with a club foot, which at the time was seen by some as a judgment from God for secret parental sin. His older brother was born with the same condition in both feet. The boy's father, Joshua Stevens, was a farmer and cobbler who struggled to make a living in Vermont. After fathering two more sons born without disability, Joshua abandoned the children and his wife, Sarah. The circumstances of his departure and his subsequent fate are uncertain. He may have died at the Battle of Oswego during the War of 1812. The Battle of Oswego, also known as the Battle of Fort Ontario, it says here was a partially successful British raid on Fort Ontario and the village of Oswego, New York, on May 6, 1814, during the War of 1812. So that's where his father may have perished, and no one knows, apparently. Sarah Stevens struggled to make a living from the farm, even with the increasing aid of her sons. She was determined that her sons improve themselves, and in 1807 moved the family to the neighboring town of Peacham, Vermont, where she enrolled young Thaddeus in the Caledonia Grammar School, often called the Peacham Academy. He suffered much from the taunts of his classmates for his disability. Later accounts describe him as, quote, willful, headstrong, and, quote, with a, quote, an overwhelming, burning desire to secure an education. So this guy fought through a lot of disadvantages. He's a remarkable human being. So then it talks about his career as a lawyer in Gettysburg. So he was able to graduate, university and all that, despite his poverty and everything. He graduated from Dartmouth in 1814, and I think Dartmouth is one of the best schools in the country. I think it's part of the Ivy League. I should know this, but I don't. So who cares? The thing is that but I do know that Dartmouth is a very good university. So he was able to. It says here at Dartmouth, despite a stellar academic career, he was not elected to Phi Beta Kappa. I'm not sure what that means. I think that's an honor society. But he was not elected to it. And it says here this was reportedly a scarring experience for him. So he was constantly rejected. Despite being a remarkable human being, he was constantly rejected. So he was a lawyer in Gettysburg, and he was apparently very good as a lawyer. People remarked on his very talented abilities as lawyer. It talks about him and his anti-masonry stance. And as many of you may know, a lot of the founding fathers were Freemasons. Washington was, I think he was the head of some lodge, I forget which one. The word's not head, I think they call them Grand Master or Grand Wizard. that's KKK. But the thing is that America's so it's interesting that he was anti-Freemason. And a lot of the founding fathers were Freemasons, so in a certain kind of, I don't know if that's a valid logical step, but in a sense it's as if he was against a lot of what was wrong with the founding fathers. He was also a crusader for universal education. He believed in free education for all. And so the thing is that he began to become zealous about the end of slavery, and let me continue reading here. I want to get to the part where we reach Reconstruction, I'm trying to think of what we can talk about here. Okay, let me read a little bit of this. In January of 1867, Stevens introduced legislation to divide the South into five districts, each commanded by an army general empowered to override civil authorities. These military officers were to supervise elections with all males of whatever race entitled to vote, except for those who could not take an oath of past loyalty. Most white Southerners could not. The states were to write new constitutions subject to approval by Congress and hold elections for state officials. Only if a state ratified the 14th Amendment would its delegation be seated in Congress. The system gave power to a Republican coalition of freedmen mobilized by the Union League, carpetbaggers, and cooperative Southerners, the last dubbed scalawags by indignant ex-rebels in most Southern states. These states ratified the 14th Amendment, which became part of the Constitution in mid-1868. So the thing is that you can see from all of this that Stevens saw the South as a conquered territory. We conquered the South. And it's important to point this out. And Lincoln fought this concept tooth and nail, that the Union was not, the Civil War was not to preserve the Union. The Civil War was to conquer the South and create a new United States. And you might say, well, isn't that the same thing? No, it's not. When the South seceded, they were a different country. They were just rebelling. No, they were a different country. Well, you can't say that. Yes, I can. And the reason why, first of all, I just said it, so yes, I can say it. I just did. But aside from that, the thing is, even conservatives who are, strong constitutionalists and, oh, I love my Constitution and my founding fathers, yum, 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 I love them so much. These people always say, when you talk to them, they always say, the states gave birth to the country, not the other way around. The states ratified the Constitution. So the Constitution is beholden to the states. The states decided, they chose out of the goodness of their hearts to join the Union, vote, ratify the Constitution, and join this country. In other words, from the conservative perspective, this country owes its existence to the kindness of the states who chose to join it. You see what I'm trying to say? They never see the states as having submitted themselves and say, I submit to a higher state of things, and I'm going to join this country and surrender myself. It's kind of like what, and it's ironic because conservatives, when they think of people who immigrate, they say, no, you should leave behind what you left in your other country, and you're not going to submit under this new country that you're choosing to live in. And that is exactly what the states were supposed to have done. But under the constitutional system and the federal system that was established, that's not what happened. The states did join, like, I'm still my own sovereign self, but I'm going to join this federal confederacy here, and I'm going to sign this agreement that I agree with this very weak and loose federal government, but I'm going to be my own person still. It's like somebody who marries someone else but says, I'm still single, but yes, I'm with you, but I can still date. Kind of an open marriage. That's what that's what was founded in 1788 and 89. It was an open marriage. So the thing is that the states gave birth to America. It's like the Constitution has to be like happy, or the country, the federal government has to be so happy that the states chose to join it. And if that's the case, if the conservatives talk like that, and that's exactly what happened, then when South Carolina said, the hell with all y'all, we're going to secede, and they did the Fort Sumter thing, and they seceded, then at that moment, they said, we no longer want to be part of your system. We gave birth to you. We gave life to you. We're going to take it back now. We're not going to be part of you anymore. Just like when America said, we're not going to be part of England anymore. I forget where it is. I think it's the Declaration of Independence where it talks about when there's oppression and tyranny, then the people have a right to separate themselves from that tyranny. Based on all of that, you could say, technically, South Carolina had every right from a legal standpoint, not a moral standpoint, but from a legal standpoint to secede from the Union. They were not obligated to stay under it forever and ever. They ratified the Constitution. They were saying, we don't want to be in the system anymore. I'm getting the hell out of here. And then the other southern states said the same thing. So they formed this that country actually existed and had legal validity. From a legal standpoint, it was a valid country. So when the North started fighting against the South, what they were doing is they were invading a foreign country. And
well, then
are you saying that it should have never happened? No. There's nothing, and I know this is going to sound controversial, but there's nothing inherently evil with an invasion. Some invasions are morally justifiable. The invasion of Iraq, so many things. When Americans set foot in Normandy to set it free from the Germans, I mean, it was occupied by the Germans. We had nothing to do with any of that. So we were technically invading a place that was controlled by other people. So invasions are not inherently wrong. Some are wrong, obviously, but just because something is an invasion doesn't make it wrong. But the thing is that the North, when they started fighting the South, it was a battle between two countries, two sovereign countries. And the North was saying, I am going to take you over and force you to join me again. Stevens had this more clear understanding. Lincoln never saw it as that. He just saw it as some people just rebelling, like a certain rebellion, like a temper tantrum. The state's throwing a wobbly, but they were never technically away from the Union. Well, then if they were never technically away from the Union, then what the hell was the 1864 election about? Because obviously the South did not participate in the 1864 election that Lincoln won, by the way. So if those states were not part of the election, but they were still part of the Union, then that election should be invalidated. You see what I'm trying to say? You can't have your frosted pastry and eat it too. Either it was a foreign invasion of a sovereign country, or it wasn't. And if it wasn't, then you have to put into question everything. The 1864 election and so many other things. And then you have to put into question, well, then what the hell were we saying when we wrote that the states are the ones who are giving birth to the country? Then the states have the right to secede if they want to. So the thing is that Stevens understood we were doing an invasion of a foreign country when we invaded the South, and we took it back because we had the moral imperative to end the slavery that we as Northerners had allowed to exist in the South for so long. If you catch what I'm saying, we had moral responsibility. We had allowed this system to go on, a system that we were silent participants in, and we had the moral responsibility, the ethical and moral responsibility to end that slavery and to restore the greater destiny of this country, of America as a whole, not the legal entity, but the conceptual entity that that nation called America, regardless of how it was divided legally, we had the responsibility to restore its destiny. And it was destiny would not be restored, not our own, not the South's, not anyone's, if we didn't invade the South and end slavery. So Stevens understood it as an invasion. And that's why he saw it as, you know, and when you invade a country, civil liberties and all that stuff, you know, goes out the window. You know, you don't, because you're invading, you're taking over, forcibly taking over. And he understood that. Lincoln never quite caught that concept, the moron that he was. And speaking of that, I don't think we're going to get to the other man, but let me just divert for a second and talk about the Wade-Davis Bill of 1864. And this is related, so it's not like we're going completely off topic, but the Wade-Davis Bill of 1864... H.R. 244, that's its official code, was a bill, I'm reading from the Wikipedia article, was a bill to guarantee to certain states whose governments have been usurped or overthrown a Republican form of government, unquote, that's a bad sentence, but proposed for the reconstruction of the South. In opposition to President Abraham Lincoln's more lenient 10% plan, the bill made readmittance to the Union for former Confederate states contingent on a majority in each ex-Confederate state to take the ironclad oath to the effect that they had never in the past supported the Confederacy. The bill passed both houses of Congress on July 2, 1864. And speaking of 1864, we were talking about it a moment ago. So it was in the middle of the war, towards the end of it. But so the bill was passed by the Congress, by the House and the Senate. But it was pocket vetoed by Lincoln and never took effect. And pocket vetoes, I think we mentioned once very briefly before, is you know, when a bill is passed by the House, by Congress, it goes to the president, and then the president signs it, and then it becomes law. But he can also have the power, according to the Constitution, to veto it, say, I don't like it. So that means that if the Congress still wants the bill to be enacted, they have to vote on it again. And if it passes by a supermajority, I think a 60% or something like that, then in both houses or something, I forget the exact numbers, but it has to be a supermajority in both, if I remember correctly, then they can override the veto and make it the law of the land. But the thing is, because the founding fathers were so, you know, such geniuses, as the conservatives always say, the founding fathers, it never occurred to the founding fathers, what happens if the bill gets to the president and he never signs it, but never vetoes it either. See, the thing is, a good system is always looking for that little kind of edge case scenario that exposes its weaknesses. And like if you're a software developer, that's what you do constantly. You're always looking for that edge case scenario that's going to break the code, that's going to break your software. And that's how you make robust software. When you say, oh, what happens if the user just types, presses enter until his, you know, his finger starts bleeding? You know, that scenario is very unlikely, but maybe, you know, if he kind of like passes out and falls on the keyboard, maybe that will happen. His face falls on the keyboard. So you start thinking about all these crazy scenarios, like, what happened? Will that break the software? Will that throw an exception or something like that? So that's how you build robust software, by thinking of the crazy scenarios. But this scenario is not that crazy. But the system was so poorly written, poorly designed, that no one, not Madison, not George Washington, not Cool Hand Luke, nobody thought about the idea, what happens if the president just sits on the bill and doesn't veto it, but doesn't sign it either? What do we do then? They never thought of a time limit or anything in that sense. So that's what a pocket veto is. When the president says, oh, okay, it's on my desk. Have you thought about it? Yes, I'm thinking about it. Are you going to sign it? I don't know. I'll let you know. And the reason why a president would do that, of not vetoing it, is because he knows that if he vetoes it, then the Congress can then go ahead, proceed to the next step of overriding his veto through a supermajority. And Lincoln, son of a bitch, said no. You know, and you know why? Because he wanted reconciliation. He wanted his 10% plan that we've talked about very briefly before, or semi-briefly. And I think, I don't remember all the details, but I think basically the 10% plan was, if 10% of the people vote allegiance to the Union in a former rebellious state, then the state can be readmitted into the Union. It was a very lame parameter to reinstate a Confederate state back into the Union. Basically says, this proclamation decreed that a state in rebellion against the U.S. federal government could be reintegrated into the Union when 10% of the 1860 vote count from that state had taken an oath of allegiance to the U.S. and pledged to abide by emancipation. Are 10% of you okay with the Union and against the Confederate rebellion? Yes, okay, you're back in. 10%. So 90% could be pro-Confederacy, pro-rebellion, pro-slavery, and that's fine. We just want 10%. That's enough for us to let you back in. That's what Abraham Lincoln wanted. And the Republicans, the radical Republicans, said, no, that's not good enough. And so they drafted this Wade Davis bill, and Lincoln just pocket vetoed it. It was introduced in the Senate by Ira Harris of New York in February of 1863, and it was written by two radical Republicans who are worth mentioning, Senator Benjamin Wade of Ohio and Representative Henry Winter Davis of Maryland. It says here, it proposed to base the Reconstruction of the South on the federal government's power to guarantee a Republican form of government. The bill was also important for national congressional power. Although federally imposed conditions of Reconstruction retrospectively seem logical, there was a widespread belief that Southern Unionism would return the seceded states to the Union after the Confederacy's military power was broken. This belief was not fully abandoned until late 1863. The provisions, critics complained, were virtually impossible to meet, thus making it likely there'd be a permanent national control over the states formerly in rebellion. And I read that and I go, and what's wrong with that? Conquered territory, baby. You know, we conquered you, you sons of bitches. So you're going to do our bidding until you bend the knee and recognize you're wrong. And the South did not bend the knee for the next 100 years. Oh, that's not the case. Well, just, you know what I think of? If anyone starts questioning that, I see an image in my head of the Alabama, I think it was in Selma, I forget, or Montgomery, you know, with those big hoses, hosing down all the black people, peacefully protesting on the streets, and with these powerful, you know, water hoses. And the Alabama police sending their German shepherds to go in and bite the black protesters in 1960 something. It's 100 years after. So, permanent national control over the southern states would have been perfect. They deserved it, and they might have broken much earlier than 1964. If we had done it that way. So the thing is that and I know this is not directly related to Thaddeus Stevens, but he was part of this, obviously, supportive of all of this. The thing is that Thaddeus was he was a strong fighter against Johnson and wanted the South to really, really, really change in its attitude towards black people. And he was very radical about it. He led the fight to impeach Johnson. So I'm going to skip over the whole detail of the impeachment. And the thing is, the impeachment failed. It was a great sense of sadness in his heart. Let me read his reaction when the Senate failed, because the impeachment means a trial. Johnson was tried by the Senate, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know exactly how the whole thing works, but he was tried. There was an impeachment trial, and he was acquitted. And let me read his reaction. Most radicals were confident that Johnson would be convicted and removed from office. Stevens, though, was never certain of the result, as Chief Justice Chase, the former Treasury Secretary, made rulings that favored the defense, and he had no great confidence Republicans would stick together. On May 11th, the Senate met in secret session, and senators gave speeches explaining how they intended to vote. All Democrats were opposed, but an unexpectedly large number of Republicans also favored acquittal on some or all of the articles. Counting votes, managers realized their best chance of gaining the required two-thirds for conviction was on the Stevens-inspired Article 11. And when the Senate assembled to give its verdict, they scheduled it to be voted upon first. The suspense was broken when Kansas Senator Edmund Ross, whose position was uncertain, voted for acquittal. This meant that with the votes of those who remained, the president would not be convicted on that article. The article failed 35 in favor to 19 opposed. So that was that close, 35 in favor, 19 opposed. I guess they needed a two-thirds vote. And they would have had it with 36 to 18 if this Edmund Ross had voted against Johnson. In the hope that delay would bring a different result, Republicans adjourned the Senate for 10 days. Stevens was carried from the Senate in his chair. One observer described him as, quote, black with rage and disappointment, unquote. And when those outside clamored for the result, Stevens shouted, quote, the country is going to the devil. And Seth, these words are more prophetic than we wish they had been. Because the country is going to the devil in a few weeks from the time of this recording. That was a prelude. And interesting, they mentioned May 11th, because if you go to the website where these articles are posted, May 11th, 2005 was the first clear sign. Something happened in Washington that day. I forget what it was, but we wrote about it, and it was like the first clear sign that this country is going to delay its own restoration. It's going to get in the way and stonewall the truth and prevent the restoration that was going to bless it. You know, isn't it stupid to hold off something that's going to help you and transform you and liberate you? But that's what the country said on May 11th, 2005. It was the first sign when I realized, and that was almost 18 years ago, or more than 18 years ago. That's when I began to see, oh, okay, we're in trouble. We are in trouble. And if you read the website where these articles, these recordings are posted, you will see that we just kept saying, oh, it's getting, oh, trouble, 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 trouble. It's like we were being given a chance after chance to change, to correct ourselves, but we never did. And, you know, we can only be given so much time to change. And enough is enough. And that's why we're dying. But it's interesting, May 11th, that's when the Senate met in this secret session and talking about how they were going to vote and all that. And then they delayed the voting for 10 days. So interesting, May 11th to me is always a date of delay. And they delayed the vote, and then eventually they missed it by one vote. Our restoration was delayed because we were being given a chance. Just like here, it says, in the hope that delay would bring a different result, Republicans adjourned dissent for 10 days. So it's like the truth kept waiting for us to change as a country. It was just delaying. Okay, I'm going to give you another chance. I'm going to give you another chance. And we've been given a chance for almost 20 years. And we just don't want to change. And I'm going to read this last part. And I think we're not going to get to the other guy. I'm just going to read the section called Final Months and Days in this article about Thaddeus Stevens on Wikipedia. It says, during the recess of the impeachment court, the Republicans met in convention in Chicago and nominated Grant for president. Stevens did not attend and was dismayed by the exclusion of African-American suffrage. As you know, I despise that term, African-American, of Black American suffrage. From the party platform, as radical influence began to fade in the Republican Party. Remember, this is 1868. This was during the recess of the impeachment of Johnson in 1868. So the Republicans had their Republican convention in Chicago, and they nominated Grant. But it was clear, like, the signs were there, and Thaddeus saw it and was dismayed. You know, they excluded Black suffrage from the party platform. They excluded it. The party that was founded on freeing Black people and ending slavery in the 1850s, now that they were in control, they would not put in the party platform Black suffrage. In other words, you know, fighting for the rights of Black people to vote. You know, it's like, I don't know, it's like the, I'm trying to think of an example, a fan club of some celebrity, Doris Day, I don't know, the Doris Day fan club, not mentioning Doris Day in their club platform. It's the Republican Party was born for the specific purpose of fighting injustice against Black people in America, and they excluded Black American suffrage from the party platform. And it says here, as radical influence began to fade in the Republican Party. I hate the term, as radical influence. Oh, those radical people. Those extremists. When the Senate returned to session, it voted down Articles 2 and 3 by the same 35-19 margin as before, and Chase declared the president acquitted. Stevens did not give up on the idea of removing Johnson. In July, he preferred several more impeachment articles. The House refused to adopt them. So he said, let's get the son of a bitch. Let's get the son of a bitch. Because this guy deserves to be thrown out of office for all the stonewalling he's been doing. But the House said, no mas. That's it. So he offered a bill to divide Texas into several parts to gain additional Republican senators to vote out Johnson. So he was determined. And I know someone in Texas go, oh, how dare he? But, you know, you were on the wrong side of truth at that time, Texas. So I would have had no problem with Texas being divided as long as we finally did what the truth was demanding that we do. So the bill to divide Texas was defeated. and the Herald, I'm not sure what newspaper, I guess the New York Herald, or I don't know, the Herald, stated, quote, "It's lamentable to see this old man with one foot in the grave pursuing the president with such vindictiveness," unquote. Listen to that. Because this man was so zealous about the truth that he looked like a crazy man. And that's how they labeled him. When the man who was evil here was Andrew Johnson. He was maybe I've seen photos of Andrew Johnson, and the odd thing about it is he doesn't look evil. Like some people, when I see them, I go, oh my goodness, that guy has a problem. That guy is evil. But you look at Andrew Johnson, he looks like nice and likable. And I'm sure he must have been a very likable man in real life. You know, like you talk to him, very amenable, I think that's the term. Very likable and all that. But the son of a bitch wanted black people oppressed. So with the smile and the nice, easy personality, I mean, at the end of the day, who was showing more hatred, more evil? Andrew Johnson or Thaddeus Stevens? But, you know, appearances are deceiving. And the extreme, that parameter of judging things by whether they seem extreme, you know, distorts people's understanding of who's right and who's wrong. So this says here, nevertheless, Stevens planned to revisit the question of impeachment when Congress met again in late 1868. Brody suggested, I don't know who Brody is, that Stevens' hatred of Johnson was the only thing keeping him from despair, aware as he was of the continued violence in the South, some of which was committed by the Ku Klux Klan. Several of the Southern states had been readmitted by this time. The murders and intimidation were aiding the Democrats there in restoring white rule. So Stevens was looking at all this and saying, all that we fought for, the 600,000 lives that were lost in this fight, all that we lost for is being stripped away. And he was just full of despair and anger at this, like this frustration, this helpless frustration that he couldn't do anything to stop it because no one understood what he was feeling. So it says here, several of the Southern states have been readmitted at the same time. Okay, the murders and intimidation were aiding the Democrats there in restoring white rule. With the Republicans unwilling to embrace black suffrage in their platform and the Democrats opposed to it, Stevens feared Democratic victory in the 1868 elections might even bring back slavery. He told his fellow, you know, and it didn't. Well, first because thankfully Grant won. But then in 1874, we've talked about that horrible election that shameful election in American history, shame to America for what happened in 1874. So in a sense, slavery was restored. It was just in a more subtle form. And it lasted for 100 more years. So it says here, he told his fellow Pennsylvania politician, Alexander McClure, quote, look at these words, or hear these words. My life has been a failure. With all this great struggle of years in Washington and the fearful sacrifice of life and treasure, I see little hope for the Republic, unquote. These words are so fitting today. Yes, we did survive, you know, after 1868 up until now, but we're about to die. I have to look at my watch to see when we're about to die, because that's how close we're getting. And then it says here, Stevens took pride in his role in establishing free public education in Pennsylvania. When interviewed by a reporter seeking to gain his life story, Stevens replied, quote, I have no history. My lifelong regret is that I have lived so long and so uselessly, unquote. Nevertheless, in his last formal speech to the House, Stevens stated that, quote, man is still vile. Such large steps have lately been taken in the true direction that the patriot has a right to take courage, unquote. So, and then when Congress adjourned in late July, Stevens remained in Washington, too ill to return to Pennsylvania. Stevens was in pain from his stomach ailments, from swollen feet, and from dropsy. By early August, he was unable to leave the house. He still received some visitors, though, and correctly predicted to his friend and former student Simon Stevens, no relation, that Grant would win the election. On the afternoon of August 11th, his doctor warned that he would probably not last through the night. His longtime housekeeper and companion, Lydia Hamilton Smith, his nephew Thaddeus, and friends gathered by him. Two black preachers came to pray for him, telling him that he had the prayers of all their people. He sucked on ice to try to soothe the pain. His last words were a request for more of it. Thaddeus Stevens died on the night of August 11th, 1868, as the old date departed. And that was the end of a great American man, one of the 20 greatest Americans of all time. He may be in the top 10, who knows, but definitely a great man. And we'll talk about the other man in the next audio snippet. Thank you very much for listening.